from WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point this week, Horror in Orlando, a renewed call for some kind of gun control and grief. In Florida, mother Christine Lenonen lost her only child, Christopher, in the nightclub attack. Here she was on that long night.
I don't know where my son is. No one can tell me where my son is. If he's been shot, if he's dead.
Senator Christopher Murphy of Connecticut took to the U.S. Senate floor with a filibuster for gun control.
It is devastating to the families who live through this trauma to watch the United States Senate do nothing.
And the Orlando shooting victims were remembered in a somber vigil.
Stanley Almodovar III. Amanda Alvear. Oscar A. Aracena Montero.
This hour on Point, a weekly news roundtable with Catherine Welch, Janet Hook, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What is your reaction to the shooting in Orlando, to its aftermath, and what now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from Orlando, Florida, is Catherine Welch, news director at WMFE, the NPR affiliate in Orlando. Catherine, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you, Tom.
From Washington, Janet Hook joins us, national political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Janet, welcome. Thank you for being here today.
Sure. Thanks, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Janet, and Catherine.
Here's just a little bit from Orlando's chief medical examiner. This is Joshua Stephanie talking to the New York Times about what he saw at Pulse, the nightclub, after Omar Mateen's attack.
It's almost surreal. What you saw was drinks that were just served. You saw bills that were about to be paid. You saw half-eaten food. So the scene itself was almost like everything just stood still. The time just stopped. And that's not even thinking about the bodies and the blood.
The chief medical examiner, Joshua Stephanie, just about losing it there. We have implications large and finer grain to look at today. Catherine Welch, can you just take us first to the assessment at this point, at this week's end, of law enforcement's performance on that terrible long night? We've seen they've come out, they've talked about it. Does it appear that this was handled as well as it might have been, Catherine?
You know, here in Orlando, all of the elected officials, the governor, the president met with law enforcement yesterday. Right now, locally, they're all standing behind the decisions they made. Naturally, you're going to have your Monday morning quarterbacks. There are a lot of questions. What happened between 2 and 5 o'clock in the morning? As you know, the first shots were fired at 2 a.m. Took them a couple of hours before they rammed that bear cat through the bathroom wall and ended the situation at around 5 a.m. I know this station and other media outlets are making FOIA requests for police texts and emails to find out what kind of chatter was happening. How were these decisions made? There have been a few conflicting reports. I had the police chief tell me that no shots were fired between 2 and 5. And then we had a survivor's account who was in a handicap stall in the bathroom with a gunman who said another person was shot and killed during that time. So I think there's a lot of fog of war right now, a lot of unanswered questions. But by and large, this city is standing behind its police force.
The police say they were worried about a bomb, that he had the building rigged to blow. Is there evidence that that was true or not?
You know, that's a good question, Tom. And Mayor Buddy Dyer had told the media a few days ago that there was some kind of an object next to his body that made them wonder if it was a battery pack or a detonator. And he said it was unclear whether the shooter's body was laced with explosives. When they gave that first press conference at 7 o'clock on Sunday morning, I was there, and they just said he had some kind of device on him. You ask questions about it, and your answer is this is an ongoing investigation. So those questions remain unanswered.
A lot of people with big questions still there, because who knows? We're told this may happen again. How we handle these things really matters. Janet Hook, what about at the political level? At week's end, how do you see this sorting out? Is there any kind of consensus emerging here on how to respond, or is this going to be a new point on a battle line?
Really, it is. You couldn't have seen more different reactions from the two main presidential candidates. And in Congress as well, you don't feel like there's any kind of consensus emerging. I think that both in terms of the implications for policy on terrorism and on gun control, I don't see any coming together. In fact, if anything, it polarizes the parties more than ever. On the very first day after the shooting, both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton gave speeches about their response on terrorism. And really, it defined their differences more than it represented any coming together.
We've got Obama here, the president from the Oval Office on Monday, talking about how issues came together here, issues of guns, issues of terrorism.
My concern is that we start getting into a debate, as has happened in the past, which is an either-or debate. And the suggestion is either we think about something as terrorism and we ignore the problems with easy access to firearms, or it's all about firearms and we ignore the role, the very real role that organizations like ISIL have in generating extremist views inside this country. And it's not an either-or, it's a both-and.
Not an either-or, it's a both-and. We'll come back to guns. But, of course, as you say, Janet, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton's responses, rather different. Here was Trump, this was Monday, Manchester, New Hampshire, renewed his call to ban immigration of Muslims.
When I'm elected, I will suspend immigration from areas of the world where there is a proven history of terrorism against the United States, Europe, or our allies, until we fully understand how to end these threats.
He went on to place responsibility for Orlando at the feet of the president. Here was Hillary Clinton on Tuesday in Pittsburgh reacting to that.
Just one day after the massacre, he went on TV and suggested that President Obama is on the side of the terrorists. Even in a time of divided politics, this is way beyond anything that should be said by someone running for president of the United States.
Jack Beatty, we'll go to the gun issue, terror and more, but how do you see the politics of this playing out?
Well, I think in Mr. Trump, he went over the course of several days, really from narcissism to xenophobia, to infamy. The narcissism, his initial tweets were, "See, I was right." He was taking credit for having predicted there would be future attacks. That was his first reaction to this horror. Xenophobia, the speech was just, you know, shut down Muslim immigration, shut down immigration from countries that are where there are terrorists, false claims about flooding in of refugees from Syria. In fact, there have been 2,000, I think, in the last 3 or 4 years. And then to infamy, to actually charge or intimate that the president, something right out of the deep dish paranoia, that the president is somehow complicit. You know, he favors ISIS over Americans. You can't imagine a more bizarre reaction, and it's hurting him. You know, let's look at it. I mean, latest numbers, 70% unfavorable, 50% of likely voters say never Trump, Clinton up 12 points in a recent Bloomberg poll, more agree with her about how to handle terrorism than him. Republican leaders are treating him like a pariah. It's not been a good week in any sense for Mr. Trump.
Janet Hook, it's hurting him. Is that clear to you that it is or will hurt Donald Trump, his vivid response?
Well, our predictions that Donald Trump will be hurt by outrageous things that he says have been defied time and again over the course of the year that he's been running for president. One thing that is really different and I think ominous for him in this controversy, both in terms of the Muslim ban and the things that he was suggesting about President Clinton, President Obama somehow being on the side of ISIS. Both of those things, as Jack was saying, kind of went this extra mile of inflammatory nature that other Republicans are really pushing him back and keeping him at a distance on those things. And I think that the reaction you see from his fellow Republicans is probably the most ominous sign for him.
Catherine, what about anything more that we've learned about Omar Mateen's motivations? We've heard the head of the Senate Committee on Homeland Security asking Facebook to dish up more of what he was posted there. But what more have we learned about Omar Mateen, about his wife, about what may have driven him to this terrible attack?
Well, his wife has gone into seclusion, and what we do know has come from that Senate committee is that he posted a political statement on Facebook saying, quote, "You kill innocent women and children by doing U.S. airstrikes. Now taste the Islamic State." We hear that he texted his wife while holed up inside the bathroom, wanted to know if she'd seen the news. He not only called 911 to profess his allegiance to ISIS, but also a local statewide cable news channel. So in terms of whether he was really affiliated with this group or whether he wanted to be affiliated with this group, he definitely has tried to put that stamp on this attack.
Though it's fascinating. We're seeing all these reports now about how all the way back in his childhood, in his school days, serious disciplinary problems with Omar Mateen, suspended again and again and again, scores of disciplinary actions in elementary school.
Yeah, he was a poor student. As you said, a disciplinary record. He flunked classes in middle school. What's interesting is his high school students, co-students, remember him wanting to be a cop. And in fact, he tried twice to get into the local police academy. The latest was just last year, but he did not get in. He was a prison guard for a while, got fired for that. He then was a security guard for a rather affluent community in Port St. Lucie. And that was the last job he had.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Orlando slaughter, gun debate, terror strategies. Sanders does not quite step aside with Janet Hook of the Wall Street Journal, national political reporter there. News director at WMFE in Orlando, Florida, Catherine Welch is with us. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us. What's the right answer? Answers to Orlando. What's the right move now? Is it more surveillance? Fewer assault rifles? No fly, no buy? Trump's Muslim ban? Will Washington act on guns? And who wins, who loses politically from the Orlando uproar? House Speaker Paul Ryan talked with reporters on Capitol Hill on Tuesday. Ryan criticized Donald Trump's proposal to ban Muslims from entering the U.S., which Trump had restated following the attack in Orlando.
This is a war with radical Islam. It's not a war with Islam. Muslims are our partners. The vast, vast majority of Muslims in this country and around the world are moderate, they're peaceful, they're tolerant. And so they're among our best allies.
Republican Speaker of the House Paul Ryan. President Obama reacted sharply to Donald Trump's comments. This was Obama on Tuesday.
We now have proposals from the presumptive Republican nominee for President of the United States to bar all Muslims from emigrating to America. We hear language that singles out immigrants and suggests entire religious communities are complicit in violence. Where does this stop?
Where does this stop, the president asked. Jack Beatty, speak to that question and what he's suggesting.
Well, he's suggesting that the perpetrator in Orlando was not an immigrant. He was the son of immigrants. He is an American citizen. And the president is saying the logic of Mr. Trump's position is monitor American Muslim citizens now. And then as if affirming the president's judgment, Mr. Trump shortly afterwards said, you know, Muslims aren't assimilating in this country. We've got to look at the mosque. We've got to look at the mosques. You know, there's already Trump, Michael Gerson, President Bush's speechwriter, points this out in the Post, Washington Post today. Already Trump is advocating the largest police operation domestically in American history, the roundup of 11 million undocumented immigrants. And Gerson asks, what's to stop him from rounding up the Muslims at the same time and putting them in camps? Nothing. There's no principle that he's, you know, acknowledged that he's willing to stop there. And how does Trump cast this? It's a matter of survival, he said the other day. Our nation's survival is at stake. These are drastic and dark stakes.
Janet, so there you have pushback against it. You have Paul Ryan pushing back against it. What about voters? I mean, people look at 49 dead and 53 wounded and the horror of that night, and it is shocking. Is it clear how this works for Donald Trump over the course of the rest of the campaign?
You know, I'm really interested to see what the next round of polling shows about how people react both to the Orlando shooting and to what Donald Trump has said. One thing I've noticed a lot in reporting at rallies that Trump has, where the people who show up and who are really enthusiastic about him, when you ask him specifically, well, what do you think about his proposal to ban Muslims, or what do you think about his proposal to build a wall on the border? Many of them say, oh, you know, he doesn't really mean it. He's kind of just engaging in rhetoric. And I think as presented with this kind of crisis, and then he kind of doubles down on all of these ideas, I think people will have to start taking seriously that he's really holding on to these ideas. And these ideas worked for him in the Republican primary, but really this has all come up right at the pivot point where he's beginning to face the general election electorate, which is broader and less conservative. And a lot of them are just beginning to think about the choice between him and Hillary Clinton.
Paul Ryan really tried to twist away there from the Trump message on immigration and Muslims, but certainly not all Republicans are twisting away from laying responsibility at the door of the White House. This was John McCain Thursday afternoon telling reporters President Obama was at fault in the Orlando shooting.
Barack Obama is directly responsible for it, because when he pulled everybody out of Iraq, Al-Qaeda went to Syria, became ISIS.
Janet, now John McCain now saying he didn't mean personally responsible, just directly responsible. I'm not sure what the distinction is there.
Well, I think he's trying to dial back because, in fact, it sounded like quite inflammatory rhetoric and a personal accusation of President Obama that people thought was kind of on par with what Donald Trump was saying. And so I think what McCain is trying to say now is, well, I really just meant that his policies led to, you know, the kind of terrorism. So it's an awkward position for him to find himself in. You have to remember also, you know, Senator McCain is up for re-election this year. And so he's walking a really fine line between wanting to not alienate Donald Trump voters in his own state and yet not want to embrace the more offensive or difficult things that he's said.
Let's hear from our listeners. Terry is calling from Orlando, Florida. Terry, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The one piece of this that is missing again in this conversation, but has been part of it in so many other shootings, is the mental health component. We do need to deal with gun violence here in America. We also need to deal with terrorism. But this gentleman, as we've just heard in your program, has been exhibiting mental health problems since he was in elementary school. Once again, we're not looking at that piece. And on top of that, you're using language, or your guests are, about Mr. Trump that are clearly mental health issues, narcissism, paranoia, these kinds of terms. And I'm concerned that in this shooting, this third leg of the table of violence here is being left out once again.
Terry, we will pick it up right now. I mean, Catherine, what about in Orlando? Terry's calling from Orlando, close to the scene of this massacre and the horror of it. How does Mr. Mateen's mental health loom? Are people looking at that? I mean, we quickly go to these huge themes of terrorism and foreign policy, and John McCain's, you know, wrapped it all together here. But clearly you've got a troubled individual here, but then there are lots of individuals who are troubled. How does the mental health piece fit in?
You know, I think, like the rest of the world, we're trying to figure out who the gunman is, what motivated him. If you remember earlier in the week, there were questions about his sexuality appearing. Clearly,
whether he himself might have been gay. I see reporting today saying the FBI is less interested in that now, or gives that less credence. I don't know where that stands.
Exactly. And his ex-wife in Colorado immediately raised the issue. She said he was bipolar, and she immediately said, this is a mental health issue. This is not, this doesn't have anything to do with ISIS. And his allegiance to terrorism, she said, is a product of the mental health system. It's definitely already being debated out there in the media. And what you're seeing, Tom, here is people in Orlando coming together. There is kindness. It's very similar to America post 9/11. Just everybody here, it's hard to put into words, but if everybody can imagine how they felt and how they treated others after 9/11, that's what's happening here in Orlando. And the word love is certainly dominating. But to echo one of the parents who talked to President Obama, she said, put politics aside and stop these mass shootings. And you're feeling that the flip side of the coin here in Orlando to this love and kindness is a bit of anger. When are we going to do something that, if mental health is an issue, when are we going to do something to keep the guns out of the hands of people like the gunman?
Let me hold that gun issue for just a second. It comes in strong when you look at mental health and more, I suppose. But another caller or two first. Chris in Atlanta, Georgia. Chris, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I definitely think that the gun issue is important, but we in this country, we have to have full equality for the LGBT community. The government is sending a message that we are second-class citizens, and it gives the impression that it's okay to beat us or hurt us, and that's just not right. We talk about ISIS, but this is happening in our own country.
What would you like to see along that line of concern, Chris? What action, if it's not about foreign policy first and foremost to you, or about gun policy first, if it's the hate crime factor is most important, or equality for LGBT community, what would you like?
I would like the passing of the Equality Act of 2016, amending the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to include sexual orientation and gender identity.
That's as straightforward as could be. Chris, I appreciate your calling. Get one more on this front, maybe Elizabeth in Boston. Elizabeth, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I'd just like to echo what that caller mentioned. And one of the things that I'd like to see right now is a wider discussion in the media about hate crimes against LGBTQ people, and specifically people of trans, people of color who are trans. I wonder why we have lost that in the discussion.
We don't want to lose it at all. For those of you who get both hours of this show, we'll give a full hour to it coming right up here. Catherine, let's go first to you again in Orlando on this front. I mean, this was very explicitly and celebrated by the community, an LGBT gay nightclub. How is that factor being held, handled, seen, responded to in Orlando?
Oh, rainbow flags everywhere. The county building just unfurled a huge rainbow flag down the building. We have a soccer game on Saturday, usually attracts about 40,000 people, and they usually wear a sea of purple. That's the color of our soccer team. They are mass coordinating people to sit in the stands in a way to create the rainbow flag in the stands. But this is more, I want to harken back to that first caller, more about symbolic gestures. If you remember way back, North Carolina and HB2, I think it was, about a human rights ordinance when Charlotte tried to pass one. Orlando has had a human rights ordinance on the books for a couple of years now. And before the shooting, there was buzz that Florida would try to do something similar to North Carolina. So what I'm going to want to see are states, southern states like Florida and other legislatures, are they going to back off of that front, pushing that front in the wake of this tragic killing?
Janet, we heard Anderson Cooper go after the Florida Attorney General in this quadrant this week, saying, hey, you know, now you sound sympathetic, but you certainly were not in the past. Do you see action on this LGBT rights front emerging from this, Janet? And once again, it comes back to politics. It takes a political change to make a concrete change. How do you see it playing out there?
Well, I don't see any big changes coming out of this. It's interesting, though, to see Donald Trump and some of the Republicans focusing on their great sympathy for the gay community through all of this. And I know a lot of gay rights activists are reacting, yeah, fine, but so you still oppose same-sex marriage and legal protections for gays in the workplace. Actually, one of the more surprising rhetorical turns that Donald Trump went to in the follow-up was to say that he is a better friend of the gay community than Hillary Clinton, and he has this whole thing about how Hillary Clinton would bring in more Muslim refugees to the United States and they're intolerant of gays. I mean, it's really he's made this a big part of his post-Orlando pitch. I don't really know how far he'll get with it, given that there's so many elements of the gay rights agenda that he hasn't been supporting.
Jack Peedy, Donald Trump is interesting on this front. He doesn't hesitate to talk about gay Americans, gay rights. What he'll do is a different thing. But we've had other Republicans this week, Mitch McConnell and others, who would not or did not even mention that angle of the story as they talked about the appropriate response.
Yes, and Catherine can talk to this. Florida's governor was very uncomfortable with it. He finally came around to what seemed a grudging identification, use of the word gay. You know, the president, I think, spoke to just the point that Chris was making, our caller, how this place was such a nightclub for gay people. He said it's not just a nightclub. It's a place of solidarity and empowerment where people have come together to raise awareness, to speak their minds, and to advocate for their civil rights. In other words, this is a place where people who are in the closet can come and be themselves and talk to others. It's almost like a political locus or a civic one, as mm-hmm. much as it is a place of entertainment. And the killer struck right at that.
Diane in Providence, Rhode Island. Diane, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling up because I think it's time for people to start turning out in the streets. We need to have a march on Washington. We need to have a march on every state capitol and every state about banning these assault rifles, to actually finally get the people voicing by our numbers, by our footsteps, so the politicians will know that there is a majority of people who are behind doing something about getting these guns out of the hands of everybody.
Diane, there's a lot of things we could focus on here. We could focus on ISIS. We could focus on mental health. We could focus on gay rights. You're looking at guns. What takes you to that as the place where you want to put your shoulder, your effort?
Because the guns are what is doing the murdering. The people pulling the triggers can only do that if they have a gun in their hand. We need to ban the sale of these assault weapons. We need to ban the sale of the ammunition, and people have to start turning out. And whoever organized the anti-war demonstrations, whoever organized that kind of thing, the nuclear freeze people, somebody organized those marches. And I hope that somebody organizes this kind of demonstration too, because we really need to start turning out to march against the sale of these weapons and this ammunition.
We'll look at national policy and what's gone down already in Washington this week on that front. But Catherine, again, in Orlando, what about the conversation around guns? He had tried to buy more in just the days before the assault here. More rounds, body armor, didn't work out. But what about the conversation on guns in Orlando?
You know, it's interesting, Tom, just hours after the shooting, as you can imagine, our talk show team was in here trying to book Republican state lawmakers to talk about this issue for Monday morning. Mm-hmm. And the first response by their people was, let us get back to you. And it was almost like a memo went out. The second response was, it's too early to talk about gun legislation. On Tuesday morning, we did have a local Republican state lawmaker, and before he could even be introduced, he said it is too early to talk about gun legislation here in Orlando. The Democrats, meanwhile, have been calling on Governor Rick Scott for a special session on new gun laws. On Sunday afternoon, Congressman Alan Grayson, now he's a Democrat running for Marco Rubio's Senate seat, he immediately called on the state to take action. He says nothing's going to happen here on Capitol Hill. It is up to you, Florida, to follow Connecticut's lead and take action.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, it's hard to look away, but there was other news. Tragedy also in Orlando when a toddler, a young boy, was dragged by an alligator into a man-made lake at Disney World and drowned. Orange County Sheriff Jerry Demings here.
We recovered the remains of the two-year-old from the water, and that body has now been turned over to the Orange County Medical Examiner's Office.
Philadelphia set a potential precedent for other cities across the country yesterday by passing a tax on sweet drinks. Here's NBC's Rima Ellis.
In the city of brotherly love today,
this tax will help.
Confrontations over a new tax on sweetened drinks.
Ayes are 13 and nays are 4. Majority members present.
Watch that space. And support for the Orlando victims came from around the world. Here, the London Gay Men's Chorus honored the dead and looked to bring comfort. We've got people asking here about the woman who we heard at the top of the show, Christine Linonen, her son Christopher, saying, where is he? Where is he? Don't know if he's been shot. Is he dead? He was, sadly, in the Pulse nightclub in Orlando early Sunday morning. We're looking at a week in the news, the Orlando massacre, the gun debate, terror strategies. Sanders not conceding this week after the last primary in the District of Columbia. Janet Hook is with us from the Wall Street Journal, national political reporter there. Catherine Welch is here from Orlando, Florida, news director at WMFE, the NPR affiliate there. Jack Beattie is here as well. You can join us. What are you thinking on Orlando, on mental health, guns, radical Islam, ISIS, and Omar Mateen, this killing? Who wins, who loses politically here? Did you hear Bernie last night? Should he soldier on or bow out, endorse Clinton? And do you want U.S. military action against Assad in Syria? Some in the State Department now asking for that. What are you thinking on the killing of the British politician out with her constituents, on Philly's sugar tax, sweet drink tax, on Disney's alligator problem? Of course, we had Christopher Murphy on the show this week, U.S. Senator from Connecticut. He launched a filibuster on the Senate floor, quickly joined by fellow Democrats, in an effort to pressure Republicans to go to a vote that would deny suspected terrorists from purchasing firearms and require universal background checks. The filibuster ended after nearly 15 hours. Here was Senator Murphy yesterday.
The idea of this body moving on as if it's just business as usual after the worst mass shooting in the history of this nation, coming on the heels of the second and the third and the fourth worst mass shooting in the history of this country, was unacceptable.
Unacceptable. Jack Beattie, this was an unusual, maybe extraordinary performance by Senator Murphy just after he spoke with us here at On Point. But is this another sort of stage set for nothing?
Well, there's certainly going to be a vote. And I think anybody who watches the last moments of this filibuster is going to be moved. And even people who, are zealous for the Second Amendment may think twice about their absolutism. He showed up. He had on a stand a photograph, a large blown up photograph of a beautiful 6-year-old boy, Dylan Hockney, in a supermarket, a Superman shirt, and he told of what happened to Dylan. He was a boy with autism, and he idolized his teacher, Anne Marie Murphy, who bonded with him. And Dylan, it's very hard sometimes for autistic children to feel close. Really, it was he wanted to be in school with her. Well, when Adam Lanza came into that classroom...
You're talking about Newtown, Connecticut now.
Newtown, Connecticut, yes. When he came into the classroom, Senator Murphy said, Anne Marie Murphy, the teacher, could have run, could have ducked, could have done anything. What she did instead was to go to this boy, to go to Dylan, pick him up and hug him. And we know that, Murphy said, Senator Murphy, because when the police came in, they found her body wrapped around his body. And he said, if she could do that much to save one life, what can you do, talking to us citizens? What can you do? What will you do to save a life? And a powerful, powerful appeal.
But Janet, we've seen powerful appeals repeatedly. This was President Obama's 10th appearance after a mass killing during his time in the presidency. And he's spoken pretty emotionally, movingly each time, and we've had really no action. Do you see a different dynamic after this very large number?
Well, I don't see a different outcome. I mean, Senator Murphy's filibuster, speaking for 15 hours on the Senate floor, did have one of his intended effects, which is that the Senate will vote on Monday on some of the gun control measures and alternatives offered by the Republicans. But I'm afraid what won't happen is that any one of them will garner enough support to pass. So that I feel like the this massacre has changed the political environment enough that the issues have come back to the forefront, but the underlying politics haven't changed enough to really change the legislative outcome. And one of our callers, Diane from Providence, who was talking about how gun control advocates should come out into the streets and march for an assault weapons ban. I mean, what gun control advocates need to do to really change the political dynamic is not just to make it a marching in the streets issue, but a voting issue. Part of the reason why the issue's been deadlocked in favor of the gun rights advocates is that the National Rifle Association and advocates for gun owners' rights have been much more politically organized and have made this a voting issue, whereas gun control advocates tend not to. They assess a politician and their position on guns is just one part, not the very first thing they consider in how they vote.
Let's go to Richard in Nashville, Tennessee. Richard, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The issue isn't the guns and the actual having the assault rifles. It's the fact that the screening process isn't good enough to weed out the people with the mental
health issues. Yeah.
And there should just be a better way to screen the mental health issues. You know, are you on a bunch of medication from four or five different doctors instead of banning the guns? Because there's more guns than there are mass shootings in the society.
By a long, long shot, I guess. Richard, I appreciate your call. I mean, Catherine, you know, just on that front, if what we saw in your city, Orlando, is a sign of a well-regulated militia, as the Constitution stipulates, then I don't understand English. Nothing well-regulated about this. What about looking at the mental health issues come up here? And of course, it goes to issues of terrorism. No fly, no buy. If you're on a no-fly zone, no-fly list, you can still buy all the weapons in this country. Are people saying, wait a minute, can't we at least tighten up the edges here?
Yeah, that's what we're hearing, Tom. And I think even back in December on Capitol Hill, there was a bipartisan bill for the FBI to prevent sales. If there was a reason to believe that somebody was connected to terrorism, you can bet there's a lot of finger pointing going on right now. Wait a minute, you guys. You know, Mateen slipped through the cracks. The FBI was looking at him twice. And would this bill had stopped him from buying? He just bought the guns, I think, like a week before the shooting.
Yeah.
Would this have stopped him? So many questions.
Zach in Lexington, Kentucky. Zach, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is this. I sell firearms for a living, and I can tell you the background screening process is very ardent and stringent. I'd like to know, from the federal government standpoint, how can someone possibly be investigated by the FBI several times, just as the San Bernardino shooters, just as Omar Mateen had been, yet still go through the NICS process and get a proceed? There are everyday average citizens who get delayed and denied just by their name matching somebody else's name. So it seems to me like the federal government is really dropping the ball here and willfully allowing these people to fall through the cracks.
But Zach, are you in the business, Zach, of gun sales?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I sell firearms for a living.
Right. So, I mean, when we read that Mateen went into a store just a couple of days before the killing, and he wanted to get 1,000 more rounds of ammunition, and he wanted body armor. And the guy at the store declined to sell those to him, but as I read it, Zach, he declined on his own hook. It wasn't because he had to in the law. He just thought this didn't look right.
That's right.
Well, that doesn't sound so tight. It doesn't sound like the law is so tight there.
Well, here's the thing. There is the NICS process is a very stringent process. Mm-hmm. The background screening process is very stringent. on top of that, if as a firearm seller, if we even have an inclination that, like, I don't think this guy is right, we are legally allowed not to sell that person a firearm. And we do it on a daily basis.
But if it's so stringent, how does a guy who with this background and as Omar come out armed to the teeth and ready to kill 49 people in a couple of hours?
Well, that's my question, because the FBI and DHS are actually the ones who do the background screening process. So my thing is this: how can the same agency that investigates these possible terrorists on a multiple times, these guys have been investigated, but he was interviewed at least four times by the FBI. The San Bernardino shooters were investigated at least two or three times by the FBI. My question is, how does the same federal agencies that create these background processes that make it so difficult for everyday average citizens to purchase firearms, make it so almost where, you know, if they've been investigated as some type of extremist, they're like, oh, that's fine, you'll get a proceed and let them slip through the cracks.
Zach, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Jack, what do you say?
Tom?
I'll come to you,
Jack. Oh, yeah, sure.
Tom?
Who's there?
This is Catherine. Yes. May I? That gun, that salesman at the gun shop that you mentioned who turned away the body armor, he called the FBI. And
But he didn't have Martine's name.
No, he didn't. But from the first press conference, they've been saying, if you see something, say something. So if you can imagine thousands, if not tens of thousands of people calling with tips, like, and this guy called the FBI but didn't have his name, how do you sort through that? How do you cross-reference and make a check? It's like the Boston Marathon bombing. You're really trying to find that needle in the haystack.
I mean, when everybody can be so easily armed, it's a huge challenge, Jack, just the scale of it, trying to sort through all this. But yet Zach says, hey, you're putting a tough standard up for regular buyers. How does this guy get through the grid?
Well, you know, Zach says it's onerous, but the Huffington Post sent somebody to a Florida gun shop, I'm not sure. And that person got a gun, and I think it was one of these assault rifles or that type of weapon. I think it was in 38 minutes. So that doesn't sound like it's too onerous. Now, the FBI, you know, the director, Comey, this week said, we are not only looking for a needle in a haystack, we're also called upon to figure out which pieces of hay might someday become needles. And that is a tremendous challenge. They have 900 active investigations, the FBI has. Agents typically can handle, and perhaps the agent who handled Mateen, 15 to 25 cases. A tremendous burden on them. Yet the fact remains, this is the third terrorist who'd been investigated by the FBI, the Boston Marathon bomber, the shooter at the Texas exhibit of the drawings of the Prophet, and now Mateen.
Michelle in Detroit, Michigan. Michelle, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Well, I guess if the guy that he attempted to buy body armor from was so concerned, he could have gone to the window of a store and gotten a license plate of the car.
I've managed
businesses and done that on my own for people I thought might be suspicious.
Yeah.
And recorded it in cases they came back in and they caused some problems. I mean, we have to be vigilant. But my issue really is here is that, we're talking about mental health. Anyone who kills another human being obviously has health mental health issues. What we need to look at is, and we're losing track of the big picture here, is that we have a global threat called ISIS that are infiltrating American citizens. Yes, this was an American citizen. ISIS isn't just in the Middle East. They are everywhere, and that's been proven in Europe. So what we need to do is stop looking at, oh, he focused on LGBTs. Oh, he's mentally ill. Oh, he shouldn't have gotten a gun.
Well, I mean, I hear you, Michelle, but I think we've got to look at all of those at once. But absolutely not take the eye off that one. John Brennan, head of the CIA, saying yesterday, our efforts have not reduced the group's terrorism capabilities and global reach. And he's talking about ISIS right there. We will look more at that. I can't get out of this hour without looking at Bernie Sanders. He didn't win District of Columbia. Here he was last night addressing his supporters in a live stream video saying he's continuing his fight.
It is about ending a campaign finance system which is corrupt and allows billionaires to buy elections. It is about ending the grotesque level of wealth and income inequality. It is about creating an economy that works for all of us.
Janet Hook, he said a lot He sounded at certain points in that speech to supporters last night like he was saying, you know, the movement will go on, but I may not. Though he never said that, and he certainly didn't endorse Hillary Clinton. What do you make of Sanders' statement?
I thought it was a real reminder that Bernie Sanders wasn't just a garden variety presidential candidate. Mm-hmm. He really did see himself and evolved into a leader of a political movement that happened to find its home in the Democratic Party. He does have one important goal that he shares with Hillary Clinton and the rest of the party, which is stopping Donald Trump. And my guess is that he will eventually come around to endorsing Hillary Clinton. But I think he really it's a hard thing for him to let go of all that he's been fighting for all of this time. And I don't think in the end that he's going to break off and do something entirely rogue. But like I said, he's just not your garden variety presidential candidate.
Is he still negotiating on the party platform? Is that what it's about?
I think he is still trying to exercise some leverage. I think he's losing it by the day, though.
Well, we'll see as we come to the conventions. We heard voices of many of his supporters saying they're not ready to give up the fight, certainly not on the issues, and that's where Bernie Sanders may increasingly be pointing. Catherine Welch, our deep sympathies to your city, Orlando, in this week. You've done an amazing job of reporting there at WMFE, and we're all grateful for the time you've taken to help us understand and come closer to the horror and aftermath of what happened there. Thank you so much for joining us today, Catherine.
Very, very kind, Tom. Thank you.
Catherine Welch, news director at NPR affiliate WMFE in Orlando. Janet Hook, you're terrific. It's always good to have you. I'm sorry the program is on such a tough issue this week, but that's just what we're looking at. You're a great analyst of it. Janet, thank you very much for joining us from the Wall Street Journal.
Always good to be with you, Tom.
And Jack, thank you as always, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.